This is the first day of this October 2008 seven-day session. And we'll go back to one of my favorite masters, Chinese masters. This is Da Wei. The text is called Swampland Flowers, the Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Wei. And this is translated by Christopher Cleary. I'll read now from the introduction, the translator's introduction. Da Wei was born in the year 1088. He died when he was 75, the age of in the year 1163. During his lifetime, just to give some reference to Western reference points, these were the years of the early Crusades. Oxford University was founded, and the Notre Dame was built in Paris. It says here, at school, he showed a preference for Buddhism over worldly studies. And even at a young age, he was considered remarkable throughout the vicinity. When he was 16, he left home. Left home means embarking on the path to become a monk. And then when a year later, he had his head shaved and officially was ordained. He took delight in the doings of the Chan school, Zen, of course. He read through the records of all of the five houses of Zen at the time, or Chan. But he especially liked the words of Yunmen, or Umon, and Yunmen's teacher, Mu Zhao. I'm going to be going back and forth between this, Christopher Cleary's introduction, his words about Da Wei's life, and those of Andy Ferguson in the book Zen's Chinese Heritage. Here it says that when he was young, Da Wei came upon a copy of The Record of Yunmen. He felt strangely familiar with the text, as though he had previously studied it. Later, he traveled and practiced under various Zen masters and became familiar with the prevailing Zen currents of the era. But he had doubts about these five different schools of Chan. He wondered, since originally there had been but one Bodhidharma, that's the founder of Zen, of course, why were there so many different schools? This is a question that commonly is framed in terms of religion in general. Why are there so many religions? There's just one truth. Well, because one truth has different ways of being expressed. And those different teachings of the truth appeal to different people of different temperament, different personalities. So we have Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and so forth. Re- religion, to the extent that it's viable, that it's real, is not just an abstraction. Because it's not an abstraction, it has to fit for different people of different ethnic groups and races and different personalities, different character. So it's only to be expected that there will be different religions and that there always will be different religions. There are, even within Buddhism, there are those who are have more of an affinity with a Zen style of teaching and practice, and there are others who have more of an affinity with the Tibetan style of teaching and practice, and others with the Vipassana. These are the three main streams of Buddhism currently in the West. So then at the age of 19, Dawi began his travels. He followed the traditional practice at the time of visiting various monasteries and meeting different teachers. Even at this early age, Dawi would be taken for a later embodiment of previous Chan masters. From one of these teachers that he met, he received instruction on the verses in the Blue Cliff record, the verses of Shui Do or Secho. And in this teaching, the teacher would not offer a word of explanation, but he made Dawi express his own view. Of course, that's the tradition. It's like Doksan. In every case, in each of these 100 cases in the Blue Cliff record, it says, Dawi, quote, completely comprehended the subtle meaning, end of quote, of these verses. And this is where we get into hagiography. Hagiography is a flattering biographical presentation where it may not be completely true in terms of fact, and it's embellished to make the subject of the biography more give them more stature. And the reason I am very skeptical that this could be true is because we'll hear later that the Dawi showed that he was deficient in his understanding. So to say that he completely comprehended the subtle meaning, at most it would mean he completely understood it intellectually, which isn't such a rare thing. There are people who are gifted intellectually and can, in Zen, and who can understand the concept, but who don't really have the direct experience. But let's proceed on with this account. The older master exclaimed, "You must be someone who's come again," meaning he must be the reincarnation of a previous Zen luminary. It says that he had long contact with the Soto Zen communities and understood their message thoroughly. Yeah, their message basically is that we're all Buddhas and always have been fully enlightened from beginningless time. So there's nothing to attain, nowhere to go. But he said he saw the the formalized, ceremonious way that they certified the transmission and repudiated it, thinking to himself, if there were transmission in Chan, how could this be the self-realized, self-awakened to Dharma of the ancestors? To this day, there is a lot more ceremony. In Soto Dharma transmission, there's a lot more ceremony than realization involved. And at our Zen teachers meetings, some of the Soto teachers have even said themselves awakening is a different model, that's their words, a different model of Dharma transmission than what they have in the Soto school. So Dawei was pretty dissatisfied with this. Later he was directed to go to a master, Chan Dong. It says that when he first got there, Dawei's intellectualism was unrestrained. One day, Chan Dong asked, "Why are your nostrils boundless today?" I don't quite get that question. And Dawei replied, "Because I'm at your place." And the master said, "You phony Chan man." This is probably a case where there's some kind of a Chinese vernacular, an idiom in Chinese that we wouldn't know in terms of this question, why are your nostrils boundless today? There too, because Zen, like any religion, is not an abstraction. In the Zen tradition, you use the idioms of the culture in which it's being taught. Masters would draw on stories and folk tales and poems and all of China, and then later Japan and Korea. We haven't really incorporated a lot of Western culture into poetry and so forth, but we're still very, very young at this teaching in our culture. Once Dawei was reading a sutra, and this master, Chan Dong, asked, "What sutra are you reading?" He said, "The Diamond Sutra." And then the master said, he quoted from the Diamond Sutra, "This Dharma is everywhere equal, without high or low. Why then is Yun Chu Mountain high and Pao Feng Mountain low?" And Dawei replied, "This Dharma is everywhere equal, without high or low." The master said, "You could be a lecturer's assistant." This is, he was so well versed, Dawei was so well versed in Zen koans, from a literary point of view. He'd done so much reading. Remember, we're told here his intellectualism was unrestrained, that he would have been familiar with some in which, in response to a challenge from a master, another master or the monk would repeat the line. And this can have real understanding behind it. It can be a good response. But apparently now Dawei still didn't have that kind of understanding, and thus his teacher's rebuke, "You could be a lecturer's assistant." did recognize, the teacher recognized Dawi's unusual potential and assigned him to work as his personal attendant. But, and I'm reading here now from Andy Ferguson, Dawi's obstinate personality clashed with his teacher, leading to an exchange in which the teacher ridiculed the young student, saying, "You haven't experienced enlightenment, and the problem is your intellectual understanding." He also said to him one day, "You understood my Chan here at once. When I had you explain, you could explain. And when I had you give informal talks or general lectures commenting on the ancients, you could do that too. There's just one thing that's not there. Do you know what?" Dawi answered, "What?" And the master said, "You just lack this one liberation that's in the burst of power. If you don't get this one liberation, there's Chan while I'm talking with you in private, but as soon as you leave the Doksan room, there's not. There's Chan while you're awake and thinking, but as soon as you fall asleep, there's not. If you're like this, how can you be a match for birth and death?" Dawi replied, "This is precisely my point of doubt." So, the teacher here nailed Dawi. He diagnosed exactly what his obstruction was, that he could be, when he says, "There's Chan while I'm talking with you in private," meaning he's well-versed in the Zen literature, maybe the koans, familiar with the koans, and maybe even more than that. Maybe he's saying, "You're present, you're engaged, you're undistracted, you're really completely present in these certain contexts, in Doksan and when you're awake and all, but it's not continuous, it's not really integrated." And to his credit, Dawi recognized that this is his failing. And then the teacher, this Chan Dong, became extremely ill. And Dawi asked him, "If you don't recover, whom should I take as a teacher so I can complete this great affair?" And the teacher said, "There's a fellow from Sichuan named Yuan Wu. Though I don't know him, you must place your reliance in him, and you'll be able to complete your affair. If you see him without completely comprehending, then go on practicing, and in a later life, you'll appear and understand Chan." Chinese, more than the Japanese, you come across this in Chinese texts, Chan texts, where they're very matter-of-fact about how, okay, you may not make it this time, but then if you really apply yourself, throw yourself into this, then your next life, then you'll be able to fulfill your bodhisattva vows, come to awakening for the sake of all beings. The Chinese took the long view. In Japanese Zen, there's more of an emphasis on now. Don't wait for tomorrow. You could die at any time. Well, of course, that's also there. I mean, in Chinese Zen, certainly there's the emphasis on the transiency of life and how quickly, or rather, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death and the need to really do everything one can now that one has found this path. But I don't recall at least in those Japanese Zen texts that have been translated into English, I don't recall not this time, next time. That does appear in a number of different Chinese Zen texts. And then Da Wei did travel to the temple of this Yuan Wu, the new master, and he heard the master give a talk to the monks. And in his talk, Yuan Wu spoke of an incident in which a monk asked Yunmen, remember that's Umon, the teacher, with whom Da Wei felt this strange affinity. A monk asked Yunmen, "What is the place where all Buddhas come forth? What is the place where all Buddhas come forth?" It's a pretty penetrating, fundamental question. All the Buddhas, all the enlightened ones, arise from where? And then, in this story that Yuan Wu was telling, Yunmen answered, "The water on East Mountain flows uphill." And then that's the end of Yuan Wu's story. And then in that group of monks, they asked Yuan Wu, after he told the story, what is the place where all Buddhas come forth? And Yuan Wu said, "Warm breezes come from the south, but in the palace there's a cold draft." And upon hearing these words, this answer of Yuan Wu, Da Wei's past and future were cut off. That's a direct quote from the record. Although there was movement, forms were unmanifested. He felt himself sitting in a still, barren place. Yuan Wu continued speaking. "It hasn't been easy, but you've made your way to this great field. What a pity if you were now to die and not be able to attain life. It's a great error to rely on words. Without knowing where you'll fall, just let go of the edge of the cliff. Let yourself do it. After you wake up, you won't be deceived again. You must believe this." So let's break this down. Yuan Wu recognized that something significant had happened to his new disciple, Da Wei. But clearly, he also recognized that it wasn't true enlightenment. "It hasn't been easy, but you've made your way to this great field, this field of formlessness, this seeing through forms." Because the Da Wei's experience, experience he had, is expressed in terms of stillness and barrenness, it may be that all he had was a clear, direct experience of emptiness. That is this realm of no thingness that is within this world of phenomena. And some students and even some teachers mistake this for genuine awakening. It's an inspiring experience to have. There are people here who have had this experience of this sudden experience of emptiness. Everything falls silent and completely still. It's not the real thing, but it is just a step away from it. And it is so confirming to have this experience that it has a great deal of value in supporting one's practice and inspiring one to continue. Leading up to this experience, Da Wei had reached a point of critical mass. On his way to Yuan Wu's place, after he left this other master, Chan Dong, he sort of set a goal for himself. He said, I'll make 9 summers the time limit. If his Chan is no different from the other places, and he falsely considers himself right, then I'll write that there is no Chan. Delving into a great sutra or treatise is better than wasting energy and getting bogged down for years. So clearly he was feeling stuck. He was feeling frustrated and bogged down. By cultivating the fundamentals, I'll not slip from being a man of the Buddha Dharma in future lives. And then when he finally did reach Yuan Wu's place, he was asking him questions all day long, it says. And then that's when this incident happened, where he had this emptying out, is how one text put it. In this other version, it says, Yuan Wu investigated and found that though Da Wei had indeed managed to get before and after cut off, so that the aspect of motion does not arise, still he was settling down in purity and nakedness. He said to Da Wei, it wasn't easy for you to get to this stage. Too bad that having died, you are unable to come back to life. Without a doubt, words and phrases are a great disease. But haven't you seen the saying, and then he quoted this verse, hanging from a cliff, let go, and agree to accept the experience. After annihilation, come back to life. I couldn't deceive you. To which Da Wei said, just based on today's attainment, I'm already joyous and lively. I can't understand anymore. Listen to that. He's had this experience. He feels joyous, rejuvenated after all this. But then he says, I can't understand anymore. Remember, this is someone with great intellectual tendencies. So for him to suddenly announce, I can't understand anymore, we can take that as a very promising development. He's beyond his intellectual understanding. He's beyond answers. He's always had plenty of answers. We read that earlier in his biography. He could answer everything. But this is not the real thing. Picasso once said, computers are useless. All they can give you are answers. In Zen practice, it's not an answer per se that we can find. There is no answer in the ordinary sense of an answer standing apart from a question. It's not answers that we need. Answers won't deliver us into a place of deep peace and rest. It's understanding. Here, Dawi is using understanding in that way, but in terms of intellectual understanding. But experiential understanding, this is something that really has little to do with answers. After that Dawi, at that experience of emptiness, Dawi was selected to be an attendant in the wood hall, whatever that is. In that position, each day he accompanied the patrons of the temple when they waited to see, and then entered the abbot's quarters for interviews. In Asian Buddhism, as in contemporary Western Zen and Buddhism, these Zen centers and monasteries and temples had to rely, of course, on financial support. And the difference is that in Asia, apparently there were a lot more patrons who did not practice Zen. They just were generous in their donations to the temple. That's not unknown in the West. There are those who don't practice who've actually been immensely generous in our building this retreat center. But it's not such a hard and fast distinction here in the West between patrons and practitioners. Dawi was actually directed by his teacher, Yuan Wu, to spend time receiving and conversing with these patrons who came calling. But whenever Dawi entered the Doksan room, Yuan Wu brought up the same saying every time. And this was the saying, having words or wordlessness, both are like clinging vines on the tree. And Yuan Wu would question them with this and say, what's your understanding of this? And as soon as Dawi opened his mouth, Yuan Wu would say, wrong, that's not it. In the other version here in front of me, the other translation of this, it's like this. It's like words without words, like a creeper or a vine held up by a tree. After 6 months of this, Dawi asked Yuan Wu, I heard that previously you questioned Wu Zu about this phrase, but I don't know what he answered. Wu Zu is another famous master who, of course, preceded Dawi. So this is the Chinese indirect style of angling for a clue. I've heard that previously you questioned Wu Zu about this phrase, but I don't know what he answered. Yuan Wu laughed, but did not reply to Dawi's question. But Dawi pressed him. At that time, you posed this question in front of everyone. Why not say it again now? Yuan Wu said, all right. Then Yuan Wu capitulated. He said, my answer to Wu Zu was, it gets a little complicated here, but what is the meaning of the phrase, He just repeats the question. It is words without words, a creeper held up by a tree. Wudzu answered me by saying, "You can't trace it, it can't be drawn." I then asked him, "When the tree has fallen down and the creeper has withered, what then?" Wudzu said, "See what comes next." And at these words, Da Wei was enlightened. He said, "I understand." So that original question was in terms of the tree and the vine, and then Yuan Wu had said to Wudzu, okay, Wudzu was his teacher, Yuan Wu's teacher. He'd said, "All right, when there's no tree, the tree's fallen down, the creeper is gone, what then?" And then Wudzu's answer, "See what comes next." At that point, after Da Wei's awakening, Yuan Wu brought up several particularly difficult koans in order to question him, and Da Wei replied to them all without getting stuck. And then Yuan Wu said, "At last you know I haven't been deceiving you." And at this, Yuan Wu accepted him as the Dharma heir of the true school of Linchi or Rinzai. It must have been a very deep realization, because Da Wei went on to become one of the most famous and the most highly regarded of all of the masters, certainly of the Linchi school, the Rinzai school. Hakuin, the great Hakuin himself, looked up to Da Wei as a model of great realization. He also looked to him as a model of reforming Chan. Da Wei, Hakuin is known as a great reformer of Zen. He brought the koan system back into real importance, but he was preceded as a reformer by this Da Wei. After his great penetration, Da Wei went back to several figures in Chan he had doubts about and asked Yuan Wu about them. Yuan Wu said, "My Chan here is like a great ocean. To get it right, you have to take a great ocean and pour it in. If you just take a bowl, fill it with a little, and stop there, it's that your capacity is only like this. What would you have me do about it? Only a few can reach your level. There was one equal to you among my students, but he has already died." And then Yuan Wu divided the teaching duties with Da Wei, and soon Da Wei became widely esteemed throughout the Chan communities. He came to the notice of a high government minister and was given a purple robe and the name Buddha Sun as a sign of imperial honor. Sun here is S-U-N. One of Da Wei's students was a government official by the name of Zhang, who became enmeshed in a political struggle. His opponent gained the advantage and managed to have Zhang executed. Da Wei was caught up in the fallout of this episode and was forced to flee with his monks. He was invited by Yuan Wu to take up residence at a certain leading monastery. The new emperor invited Yuan Wu to take up residence at a certain leading monastery, and Yuan Wu invited Da Wei to be the head monk. While Da Wei was in exile, he compiled the records of many ancient teachers along with a large number of koans. Just a comment about his fleeing. I suppose imagine someone who had a lot of silly ideas about Zen saying, well, why if he were a deeply enlightened master, why would he flee? I didn't know Zen masters were scaredy cats. But you see, running for your life can be the most intelligent thing we could possibly do. No doubt Da Wei recognized that if he foolishly remained behind and had some Neanderthal kill him, that he would be a great waste of his talents, his insight, his great wisdom. So naturally he ran, he fled, so that he could give back some of what he had gotten through his practice, through his enlightenment. In the year 1150, Da Wei and his monks were forced by social unrest to move again, this time going even farther. And there it says, plague and famine killed more than half of the more than 100 monks in Da Wei's company. Plague and famine. There's so much widespread fear today about this financial turmoil that we've gone through in the last 10 days, 2 weeks. In ancient China, there were so centuries of intermittently far worse conditions, far, far worse, famine and plague. Half of the monks killed from these. During this period, Da Wei was stripped of his imperial honors and certification and ordered away from the capital to this backcountry where it was a malarial area. Malaria was running rampant. But he continued teaching Chan and said that in one summer he is said to have produced 13 enlightened disciples. A son of the royal house, who was king over the area, was greatly impressed when he happened to hear Da Wei's talk. And this man arranged for Da Wei to be exonerated and rehabilitated, and at the age of 68, after 15 years in exile, Da Wei returned to the heart of the empire. But then he requested to be excused from official temple duties, and in 1161 he was allowed to retire to the Bright Moon Hall at Qingshan Temple. In the years that followed, Dawi emphasized that the goal of all practice is the realization of enlightenment. People who have done a reading of Chinese Zen may have read that Dawi was so critical of this silent illumination Zen. But that was exaggerated, that his criticizing it. It says here that the chief proponent of this silent illumination Zen was this famous Hongzhi. But many scholars today point out that a mutual respect and cordial relations existed between Dawi and his supposed adversary, this Hongzhi. In fact, Hongzhi requested that Dawi take care of his final affairs after he died. And then, when he was 75 years old, after showing signs of illness, Dawi told his monks and nuns and lay people, "Tomorrow I'm going." And then toward the pre-dawn hours, after he'd written his last bequest and a letter to the emperor, the monk who was his attendant asked him for a verse. In a serious voice, Dawi said, "Without a verse, I couldn't die, could I?" It was the custom to write a final verse. And he was pressed to do so, so he took up the brush and wrote the following famous verse. "Birth is thus, death is thus. Verse or no verse, what's the fuss?" Then he let go of the writing brush and passed away. There's a difference in this other account, translated by Andy Ferguson. There's something quite different here. Oh no, this is not at his death. This is just another dialogue from earlier in his life. I'll leave that out because we've come to the end of our time. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.